Welcome to another episode of the AR Lyceum. Today I'm joined with David Wood, who is a legend. He's a futurist, author of 12 books, chair of London Futurists, and he co-founded Symbian in the 90s, which was a prominent smartphone operating software, it's an operating system that was on Nokia, Samsung, and many of the large phone companies' devices, which I grew up with. So he's been there when there's been big change in technology, and he's here now for the AI evolution. So over to you, David, to introduce yourself in better detail.
It's my pleasure to be here. What I'll say about the smartphone evolution is this. It wasn't just that we were part of making that industry. It's that we also envisioned it before it was a reality. And we started talking in the late 1990s that someday everybody would have smartphones. And this was a very unpopular idea at the time. People said, what on earth will people need an electronic companion with them? They would much prefer simple, dumb phones or feature phones, as they were sometimes called. But we said, no, the utility of these devices will improve and improve. And we envision a time when everybody is carrying one. And not only did we envision it, we took the steps to make it happen. So to summarize that, I'll say I was a futurist before I knew that I was a futurist, is what we were doing, is indeed envisioning and steering towards a better future. And many of the things that went right, but also many of the things that went wrong in the smartphone industry are ripe for understanding in detail as to how they can apply to the even larger transformation that AI is going to cause. AI is still at a relatively early phase. It's perhaps like smartphones were in, I don't know, 2002. There were a few people using them and singing their praises, but it hadn't reached anything like its full potential yet.
Well, that's really interesting, because I remember growing up in that era, and I was probably using a device that you'd sold in your operating system on, so that's fascinating. How do you see AI affecting mobile phones, actually, and how we use them? Do you think we'll need mobile phones in the next 10 years?
Well, it's still unclear to what extent mobile phones will be replaced by a combination of smart glasses and smart headsets or smart hearing buds. That was something that has been envisioned for a while, and it's proved difficult to actually solve the physical engineering problems. Now, we may have that flip coming. I don't want to put a timing on it. It's harder to see the timing of changes often than to see the ultimate destination. So in due course, we probably will have less of this when we're looking down at our phones and more of this where the screen's up here. And when we're upright, it's probably good for our posture as well. And when the device's intelligence is speaking in our ears, also responding to our brainwaves so that when we are thinking of things, the device is already picking up what we're thinking of things before we say it. So that will come, but I don't think it's going to come in the next year or two yet. And what will happen with AI is that the AI app is increasingly the most important app on the smartphone. It's the app that figures out what we are trying to do and serving up things to us even before we had even asked them. And so it understands which apps we would like to use, even though we don't know the apps are there. It will understand which features of the apps to present to us so that we don't need to go looking for these features somewhere in the nest of menus that we know exists. So the more intuitive that AI appears to become, these phones, I think, will succeed more and more.
Yeah, I think I agree. I think in the next 50 years or so, we won't need mobile phones. We'll have something very different, maybe even a projector on our glasses, which projects outwards. So I wear glasses, right? You'll have a projector that projects outwards, and I can just look at a virtual screen in that sense.
Well, I think the changes will happen a lot more quickly than 50 years. When I talk about short term, it's a year or two or three. Longer term is 15 to 20 years. It's very hard to predict anything with any confidence beyond 20 years, because the likelihood is that AI will have changed so much that there are whole new concepts, whole new structures, whole new institutions. It's going to change everything.
A lot of people are saying that AI is in a bubble at the moment, but I disagree, in my honest opinion. I wondered what you thought of that.
Well, there is a lot of hype, of course. There's always that's always the case when there's new technology. There are people who claim to be experts in it, people who claim their solutions will make it easy, and often it doesn't work. And there are a lot of people who are having frustrating experiences dealing with products that don't live up to their billing or with services that turn out to be quite shoddy. Some people are getting frustrated. Especially they're getting frustrated because they're trying to apply AI incrementally inside their current processes and institutions. And to get the best out of AI, we need to change many of our processes and institutions, not doing things the same as before. So it is the case that there are many corporations or many individuals or even many countries that are on the point of failing because they are insufficiently agile, insufficiently able to create new processes and institutions. But well, these laggards, these dinosaurs, they're going to be disrupted by faster moving, nimbler, more powerful, more capable upcoming new companies. And some of the existing companies will adapt fine too. So it's not just going to be new companies who are changing everything. Some of the old companies will change, but many of the other old companies will fall into what's known as the innovator's dilemma. They won't be able to adapt because they're too fond of their existing ways, and they're so sure that their existing ways need to be preserved at all costs, when in fact they don't.
And you're speaking from a lot of experience, including being a CTO at Accenture Mobility, right? So you have that experience in making technological change. So if you were advising these companies who were quote-unquote laggards, what sort of next steps would you recommend to them to implement?
Well, there's a bunch of things I talk to my clients about. First on the list is you need to become better at learning how to learn. In other words, there's a lot of change going on, and we all need to become faster at updating our ideas and understanding. And one of the blockages to learning new things is the old stuff that's in our minds. So actually, a related skill is unlearning, setting aside what previously was important. Now, in order to do this relearning, unlearning, we need couple of other things which are incredibly important. One of them is an emotional resilience, because you have to move from being an apparent expert in the old ways of doing things to being a comparative newbie, inexperienced, somebody who's going to fail a lot in their struggles in a new world. And that requires emotional intelligence. It requires emotional resilience. So it's always been the case that successful organizations needed not just IQ, but EQ. But I would say EQ is even more important in a time of great uncertainty. The second thing that will help is you've got to tap into the right communities. Our intelligence isn't just what we know in our own company. It's what we can pick up by being connected to wider networks. And so the network that you're creating, or the community that you're creating, the Lyceum that you're creating, should be an example of the people who are able to share their insights more broadly. And just as we have to update our institutions and update our ideas, sometimes we need to update our community affiliations, because many times the communities which got us to a certain level of success are no longer the communities that are appropriate to help us deal with something new. So my advice here, and I'll put in a quick plug, you should connect to the London Futurist community, including listening to our podcast, where we have on a regular basis, much as you're doing here, Sam Raj, the interesting people who are willing to offer their futurist insights and skills. So adapting to this new community. So skill in this question is collaborative community, which means picking the communities, but also figuring out sometimes how to structure new communities and how to share ideas there. Symbian, by the way, the name Symbian, the company that I co-founded, comes from that same idea. The word Symbian has its roots in symphony or symbiosis, which is working together, different instruments of an orchestra building to a larger accomplishment. Symbiosis is in biology, where you get creatures that at first sight you think, well, why don't they eat each other? They'd be better off if this big fish ate the little fish. And then you realize, oh, the little fish, they're actually cleaning the teeth of the big fish. There's multiple examples in biology. And this is exemplified in the motto that Symbian had, which was collaborate before competing. The customers and partners and shareholders of Symbian were intense competitors, but they realized the benefits of sharing the insights of the things that transcended their individual needs. So instead of them each trying to put a lot of effort in and build their own mobile smartphone operating system, they decided they should pool that effort. And that was a very wise step. So likewise, we who are struggling to make sense out of AI need to tap into the right communities and collaborate before competing.
Really interesting. I think the future of the world seems to be in co-opetition, which is where companies work together who are competing, but to grow the industry in a sense, right, in partnerships, which we're seeing a lot of. In terms of AI as a general change for humanity, a lot of people are scared of it. And I want to touch the ethical side of it, because the ALICM is here to bring more of the ethical side into these conversations. So what are your thoughts on ethics and how it impacts this space and what we need to do to be mindful of how we deploy this?
Well, the first thing to say is that people should be scared. There is a whole set of things that can go wrong, terribly wrong, if we are naive, foolish, over-optimistic, misguided in how we adapt AI. I've talked about how individuals might fail or companies might fail if AI is applied wrongly. Well, humanity as a whole might fail if we are foolish in how we apply AI. So I'm in the group of people who see AI as an existential threat on a par with nuclear weapons or pathogens. If we are unwise, we could destroy everything that matters to us, whether that's literally killing everybody or whether that's just setting civilization back into what's sometimes called a new dark age, from which it would be hard to recover because we've already burnt all the easily accessible fossil fuels. So a second wave of humanity would have a much harder job to reclimb that civilizational apex. So that's what AI could do. Now, for me, ethics means we don't just do something because we could do it. We don't just do something because we like to do it. We have to step back and say, well, what are we truly wishing to accomplish here? What is the should? And not the could, but should we do something? And that in turn ties into questions of ultimate goals. What is it that's truly important for humanity? And too often people get focused on sub-goals or intermediate goals rather than the big ends. So they'll say, well, in order to achieve all these other things, we need economic growth. So let's make economic growth into our short-term God. And we'll pursue economic growth regardless of the consequences. Well, we hope that it will all sort out. But reality is, if we pursue economic growth for its own sake, if we pursue technology for its own sake, if we pursue AI for its own sake, we are likely to end up with what people call externalities. That's an economist's word. An externality is where you and I might have an economic transaction, but a third party or a third agency gets damaged as a result. For example, you might be teaching me how to play drums, and you're getting money from me, so that's good for you. I'm learning how to play drums, which is good for me. But the two of us are making such a racket that other people around us are saying, oh, gosh, I don't want this. But because they're not part of that economic transaction, they can't affect it. So that's pollution of noise. Of course, there's also pollution of chemicals. There's pollution of bad methods of thinking. There's a disruption to all of society. So there are possibly bad externalities. And if we just do things because it seems to be the right thing or because other people seem to be expecting it, we may well end up in a very bad place. Not just that we've caused too much noise by drumming, but we have released very dangerous technology, which can be used for all kinds of bad purposes.
Yeah, very interesting points. And on the flip side, what do you see as the biggest opportunities for AI?
So to be clear, the potential for AI is cosmic. It's cosmological. It's astonishing. It can help us to overcome all the deficits that we have inherited from evolution. Now, evolution makes us grow old and feeble and die. Evolution makes us misjudge many things. It gives us cognitive biases that might have made sense in the African savanna, but don't make sense in the very different circumstances we are now. So evolution has led us to be individually and collectively stupid. Evolution has also led us to be egotistical and to be depressed a lot of the time as a result. Evolution didn't care whether or not we were happy and fulfilled. Evolution instead wanted to cool our emotions so that we ended up procreating and passing on many genes into subsequent generations. Evolution has also made us tribal and divisive, and we abuse power. We deceive people all the time. And evolution has also made us abuse the environment, because we have always thought that there'll be plenty more environment. So evolution has given us lots of tendencies, which AI can help us in each case to transcend. So I look forward to what I call human superintelligence, human super longevity, human super well-being, and human super democracy. Indeed, I summarize it all as a superabundance, sustainable superabundance for all. That is what AI can do. AI can fulfill many of the promises, indeed, of the religions of the past, promising paradise, promising immortality. It's not too much of a stretch to say that AI, if we use it right, can help us transform other technologies, nanotech, biotech, cognitech, and between them, they can give us a paradise, a sustainable superabundance, and effective immortality, because we will no longer be aging. We can, if we wish, stay indefinitely youthful. When I say youthful, I don't mean young and foolish. I mean young, but also wise. So that's a huge possibility. And many people are in such a hurry to get there. They're called the accelerationists or the effective accelerationists. They're in such a hurry to get there that they're willing to embrace all sorts of risks along the way, which I think will be a disaster, because en route to that paradise, let's call it that, there are many landmines, many things that can go badly wrong and destroy humanity if we are rushing foolishly, which is why we've got to stop and think carefully, which is why we've got to be aware of the landmines, which is why we need to develop the skills and the institutions so that we can navigate this journey well.
Yeah, very, very important points. I like the area of cognitech. I think cognitech is one of the areas I'm finding very interesting. Which area do you think is going to be the most impacted by AI out of the ones that you just mentioned?
It's going to impact everything, you know, let's be clear. And we humans, we are complex beings with multiple dimensions. AI will affect all of these dimensions. So let's just look at it in a little bit more detail. AI, as I've said, will improve nanotech, which is the ability to control matter programmatically at the nanoscale, that's the molecular level. A bit like already happens with ribosomes. Ribosomes are part of our biology, which take strings of RNA and turn them into amazing protein machinery. So nanotech will do the same. And we've been held up with nanotech for many decades since Eric Drexler originally defined the term and described it in the 1980s. We've made comparatively slow progress so far, but AI is going to unlock nanotech. It's going to help us to do it properly. And with nanotech, three industries in turn will be disrupted. There's the energy industry. We will have safe, clean energy, abundant, safe, clean energy. It's also going to transform manufacturing and accommodation. So we'll all be in very robust, safe houses, which are free from risks from the environment. And thirdly, nanotech is going to transform recycling so that many of the things we have thrown away as waste in the past can be stopped from being poisonous or dangerous, including the poisons we have effectively put into the atmosphere, the greenhouse gases, to be clear. They can all be undone too. So that's just from nanotech. AI can also enhance biotech, which is our ability to reprogram ourselves at the genetic or epigenetic and other biological levels, such as the biome. And that in turn will transform three huge industries. It's going to transform food preparation and agriculture. That's two industries there. So we will have whole new ways of eating meat, or rather preparing meat. We will no longer need to have vast areas of the planet given over to growing crops, which we then feed to livestock, which we then slaughter and eat. We'll be able to do this all without having any sentient animals involved or harmed in the slightest. So, and the other thing that biotech will transform is our healthcare. That will give us the indefinite youthfulness. But then there's the point that you made about cognitech. And perhaps in a sense, this is the most fundamental, because at heart, although we are a body and although we are an intellect, we are also an inner consciousness. And I think that AI will transform cognitech, which is our understanding of the brain and how to improve our thinking processes. And when I say thinking, I don't just mean rational intelligence. I'll come back to the emotional intelligence I mentioned earlier. There's also a network intelligence. There's also a spiritual intelligence. And so I see the improvements in Cognitech from AI will transform, again, three huge areas of life. It'll transform education so that we can all learn more quickly. So when I was saying earlier, a big important skill is learning how to learn. One thing is going to help us to learn how to learn and learn things more quickly is AI, personal AI tutors. Then it's also going to transform entertainment. Many of the things that we watch already are influenced by AI. AI decides what things to suggest we watch next on Netflix and so forth. It suggests what videos we watch next on YouTube or on Facebook and so on. When it does that well, it's going to lead us to new heights of fascinating entertainment, including immersion in virtual worlds, where we might go and spend decades in amazingly interesting virtual worlds. And finally, it's going to transform our whole spiritual enterprise. All the religious places that people go currently for spiritual nourishment, these will be transformed by AI's better understanding of consciousness. So people will be able to talk to the religious avatars or representations of the philosophers or the religious leaders or the other inspiring figures from history that they would like to talk to. And we will have literally a kind of voice of God in our heads, which is our best advice from our AI saying, David, it's time to stop talking now and let your interviewer ask a question, or words like that.
Yeah. For me, it's just mind-boggling how in 3 years the whole world has changed completely in 3 years. When ChatGPT was released in 2022 publicly, I found it fascinating, and I was saying to everybody, this is going to change the advertising industry, it's going to change the whole world. And a lot of people didn't actually agree. They thought they wouldn't, but here we are, and it's changed everything. Where do you see us in the year 2040?
Well, 2040, there are three possible futures. One of them is a little bit like today, just a bit faster or a bit cheaper or a bit more variety. This is the business as usual scenario. And I rate the probability of a business as usual scenario as something like 5%. I think it's very unlikely we will have modest changes. And that's because I do believe AI is going to unlock these powerful, tremendously powerful agents of change. And so we will either end up in a sustainable superabundance, or we will end up in a new dark age in which there might be no humans at all, or there might just be humans at an impoverished level of civilization. And it's hard to know which of these two is more likely. I do think the sustainable superabundance is more likely because, on the whole, humanity is able to foresee the future and steer the future. But we often get things wrong, and there have been many cases in the past where civilizations did crash and burn out of a lack of foresight or a lack of understanding or a lack of coordination. So I think perhaps the 50% chance is that we'll be in a sustainable superabundance, a 45% chance that we'll be in a dark age, a hell on earth, or about a 5% chance that we'll be roughly the same as today, but a little bit faster and a little bit more varied.
Sustainable superabundance is an interesting term. I've not heard that one before.
Books. It's a nice short book, by the way. It's one of the easiest to read that I've written.
Amazing. And you've written, I think it was 12 books.
I've either been the author, or I've been the lead author, or the editor, with many of my chapters included. Yeah.
Who inspires you at the moment in terms of how they think about AI, and what are the current things you're thinking about?
So I've got to be inspired by the world's leading computer scientist. That's Yoshua Bengio. And the reason I call him the world's leading computer scientist is via something called H-Index, which is an academic system to measure not only how many times you've been published, but how many times your published work has been referenced by others. So Yoshio Bengio also is admirable because he has never accepted payments or significant payments from any of the large companies to join them and work with them. He has retained his independence in a way that other leading figures in AI have not. So, and he has a fascinating set of ideas about the way to avoid the dangers I've spoken about, and he advocates developing AI without autonomy. So AI will have intelligence, but it will not be able to initiate things on its own, of its own volition. Now, whether that's possible or not is still an open question, but he is researching that and thinking about it a great deal. So Yoshua Bengio is the first name I'll mention. The second I'll mention is Max Tegmark. So Mark started life as a physicist. He's done pioneering work in theoretical physics, in the expansion of the universe, in the cosmological background. But he also has been pioneering work in AI safety. He is one of the co-founders of an organization called the Future of Life Institute, which is based in New England. I think Max is at MIT. And they have done a lot of thinking as well about how we can avoid the dangers of AI gone wrong. I should also mention Eliezer Yudkowsky. So Eliezer's a self-taught autodidact. That's the same thing twice. Self-taught means autodidact. He dropped out of high school. He passed exams with very high grades, nonetheless. And he has been focusing longer than almost anybody else on the risks and possibilities of transformational AI. So in the year 2000, he created something called the Singularity SIAI, Singularity Institute for Artificial Intelligence, in which at that time he wanted to accelerate the arrival of superintelligence. But by 2001, he says he had realized that there would be dangers in ensuring that AI would be, as he called it then, friendly. He was worried about it being dominated by misuse. And then later on, he realized, oh, it's not going to be easy to make AI friendly. It's going to be incredibly hard. So he has recently, along with a colleague of his, Nate Soros, both of them work at what SIAI, the Singularity Institute for AI, turned into. It's got a new name. It's MIRI, the Machine Intelligence Research Institute. And they have produced a book together with the arresting title, If Anybody Builds It, Everybody Dies. In other words, if anybody anywhere in the world builds an AI superintelligence, the likelihood is it will not be friendly. Out of the vast space of possible types of design, it's almost certainly going to end up with one that doesn't care about human well-being, and that if you regard our own desires and morals as just being weird quirks, the same as we might regard ants as having weird quirks. So his book is highly commended. I've read it twice. The reason I read it twice is I read it once and thought it was very good, but I saw people online were criticizing it, and I thought what they're criticizing isn't what I remember being in the book. They're projecting their own misunderstanding onto it. But to be sure, I listened to it again, and it was even better on the second listening than the first listening. And I do confirm that many of the negative criticisms of Eliezer's book, that's Eliezer Yudkowsky, his book, are based, I think, on, well, misunderstandings or even more psychological self-defense mechanisms by people. Because if they really accept that there is this danger, they're going to have to change their lives. All of us, indeed, should be campaigning to ensure that we get the best out of AI rather than just blundering along or in a reckless race. So we are currently in a race to not let these other guys over there be the first to build superintelligence. But when we race, we are unethical, in the sense that we don't worry so much about safety considerations. We don't worry so much about ensuring that the benefits go to everybody. Instead, we are much more concerned to be the first to achieve that, because if these other guys over there get it, they'll dominate the market, or on the geopolitical front, they'll dominate the whole planet. So these are three names. Once again, that's Yoshua Bengio, Max Tegmark, and Eliezer Yudkowsky.
You have a lot of knowledge, and you must have listened to a lot of books. Do you like to read books, or do you like to listen to them?
Well, I prefer to listen, because I try to walk a lot, and when I'm walking, I can listen. Walking is part of my longevity exercise, if you like, to help me make sure I get a bit of improvement in my physical situation.
That's really good. In terms of other things that you like to do, do you like to use AI tools on a day-to-day basis for the longevity of your cognition? And if so, how do you use these tools?
So I do recommend that people use AI tools. I use it to improve my writing. I don't get AI to write on my behalf, but I will write something and then I'll feed it into AI. And amazingly, it gives me very good feedback. I don't accept all the criticisms and suggestions, but I think about all the suggestions and I can see in every case that was a thoughtful comment. And my writing improves as a result. Secondly, I use AI to produce images because, as we all know, a good picture is worth a thousand words. And so to illustrate my articles or my online comments, I will often get AI to produce a much better image than I could find if I was just looking online for something custom. So these are two ways. But thirdly, I should mention a new agent. The agent is called Aubrai. That's A-U-B-R-A-I. And people can find it at aubr.ai. The Aubrai is based on the research of a particular biogerontological researcher called Aubrai de Grey. It's been trained, the agent has been trained not just on the general knowledge which is available on the internet, but it's also been trained specifically on Aubrai de Grey's podcast appearances, of which there are thousands, his YouTube talks, his books and the articles he has written. And also, importantly, the articles that he has recommended as being particularly useful. And so this Aubrai agent is now active on social media. People can find it on X or Twitter. If you're looking for it on X, you can probably find it just from AUBRAI, but the actual agent has an underscore at the end of the name to disambiguate it from other Aubrais that already exist. So people can find it and can talk with it. And even more interestingly than the interactions that people are having with it, which is helping them to come up with new ideas in AI, helping to refine how they will do their experiments, it's associated with what's called a governance token. And the governance token is a cryptographic concept. It means that people can purchase, if they wish, governance tokens. There is a way in which you can find people who already got them, and you can purchase some from them. And by purchasing, you will become part of the community that is able to get advanced access, earlier access to some features of Aubrai, also to discuss some of the future research developments, what can be done with the ideas that arise from some of the first experiments. And people can just demonstrate their support for this kind of anti-aging research that Aubrai de Grey and myself and others are championing through this particular agent. And when people buy and sell these tokens, there's a tax. There's a 1% tax on the buying and selling, which is put into a treasury. And that 1% tax is divided up in various ways. But 70% of that 1% is available for the experiments that Aubrai de Grey's organization, LEVF, that's the Longevity Escape Velocity Foundation, conduct.
I've never heard of that tool. I'm definitely going to be taking notes of it. So it's aubr.ai for those listening.
Correct, that's right.
And I've just looked at the website. It looks really nice. I'll definitely be sharing it with the community. And I might reach out to Aubrai myself. So that'd be quite cool. How do you see consumers using AI in the next 10 years? What sort of things will change? So currently, OpenAI released a really interesting study which showed that people use it for their day-to-day tasks. In 10 years' time, how do you think consumers are going to change with the relationships going to change between them and the machines?
Well, again, I will say that most of what people think will happen in 10 years will probably happen a lot more quickly than 10 years. And it won't just be something that we interact with occasionally. It'll be something that's monitoring us with our permission all the time. That's provided we trust it, of course. And it's an open question as to whether we should be trusting the AIs that have come from these centralized corporations, whether it's OpenAI or Google DeepMind or Anthropic or X, Twitter, Grok, and so on. So each of these is probably not the kind of thing you want to give over to running large parts of our life, access to all our intimate thoughts and feelings and desires and hopes and fears. But if this can be handled properly, if we can be confident that there are sufficient security and privacy systems in place, these systems will be, these AIs will be our constant companions, like the voice of God in our head, as I've said, which we can turn on or off as we wish. And it would be like a very good friend who knows how to speak to us. Ill-intentioned friend or clumsy friends will sometimes give us feedback, but we're not able to accept that feedback. They say, what do you, we'll say to them, you don't understand my situation. That's not the right way to speak to me. But as the AI won't have these drawbacks, the AI will know exactly the right time of day or night to speak to us in the right way so that we are receptive to its suggestions and prompts rather than fighting them off as unhelpful. So AIs will be our companion for our flow of thought. It will be our companion that prompts us to exercise more. It will tell me, David, you've been sitting down too long. It's time to stand up and walk around. It will also monitor what we're eating. And if we like, it will give us suggestions. Right, you like this taste, but the particular combination you've got is actually unhealthy by these criteria. You can have the essentially the same taste, essentially the same fulfillment by mixing these ingredients instead, and so on. So it will help us all to be much better human beings. That's the vision. So it won't just be affecting science. It won't just be affecting these big industries I mentioned earlier. It will be affecting us strongly as living, breathing consumers too. And yes, it will be absorbing our time in virtual world exploration. So instead of us spending a few hours or maybe a whole weekend watching a live stream on Netflix, we can immerse ourselves into it. We can become characters in their game by being inside. And in a sense, that will be even more thrilling and even more fascinating and absorbing and enriching.
I like your point about virtual worlds, because yesterday I was watching, before I went to sleep, I watched a Demis Hassabis interview. And he showed, or talked about Google Genie, which is where you can make a world, a virtual world. And if I paint on the wall in the world and it looks really real when I'm painting, and I turn around 360 degrees and turn back, it still stays on the wall. So it's a persistent world. And the pixels only develop as you're moving in the world. So the pixels are basically, it's like the Matrix, right? Where you make something as and when someone needs it. And then when you're not there, it goes away, for example. Yeah. How do you see virtual worlds? How do you see virtual worlds evolving, and do you think that we'll be in virtual worlds within the next 10 years?
Well, we will be spending more time. Some of us will be spending more time in there. At first, people will say, yuck, this is a lazy kind of existence, but I think people will change their minds as they experience it more and more. After all, the television used to be derided as the idiot box or something like that. But then people realize it could be incredibly educational and uplifting, as well as just soul-destroying. Of course, it still is sometimes soul-destroying. We still need the judgment and discretion as to how we're spending our time. But the possibilities are enormous. The other thing it will be doing is that we will be learning skills in that virtual world, which are very useful in the real world too. So if people are shy or if people are unhappy to practice French in the real world or some other language they're learning, they can go into a virtual world and practice it to their heart's content. They can practice, if they wish, ways to approach strangers and talk to them, practice conversational lines in these virtual worlds. We can practice and improve our tennis or our golf in these virtual worlds too. And then when we come to the real world, back to the real world, we'll be better conversational partners, we'll be better at speaking whichever language we've been practicing, we'll be better at playing tennis or golf. So it's the educational aspect will be very interesting as well.
That's a very interesting analysis. Studying French or something in a virtual world, I've never thought about that. What are the implications of people doing that? How do you see it affecting people's minds and the development of the brain? Maybe there's positives, but also maybe there's drawbacks or considerations, should I say?
Absolutely. There may well be, if it's done poorly, there may well be very bad consequences. And That's the message I've been trying to stress throughout. There is a very positive future, and it's quite close to very negative futures as well. This is an example from the smartphone industry, because something we did not anticipate, we anticipated a lot in the late 1990s and early 2000s, we anticipated a lot of the possibilities ahead. We anticipated some risks. We anticipated the risk that these devices would be swarmed full of viruses and malware. We took care on the Symbian operating system to not be prone to viruses and malware. And we had various security measures built in. But what we did not anticipate is that these devices would be used by people pre-puberty and going through puberty at a time when brains are developing very quickly, and that people would, as a result, in some cases, develop more mental health problems. This is a sort of controversial area. Different people read the literature differently, but I am with Jonathan Haidt on this. That's H-A-I-D-T. He has done a lot of research into the ways in which smartphone exposure at early age, especially pre-puberty and going through puberty, leads boys and girls in different ways to be more depressed, more suicidal. Not everybody, but there's a statistical leaning. And of course, if we are interacting not just with smartphones, but with even more immersive devices and systems, virtual reality built into very powerful AI, there will be more risks of this going wrong, which is why it's very important that the companies who are doing this, they are held to very high standards, that there is indeed independence, that they're not being driven for a profit motive, that they're being instead developed for, say, democratic, humanitarian purposes, ideally in a decentralized way, something that's owned by all of us rather than just for the sake of the short-term goal of commercial benefits, which I talked about earlier.
The democratic part is very interesting because it gives us all shared ownership of the future of humanity. And I think we may come to a point where all of the leaders in this area make joint decisions in a way where they say, look, we're going to work on this together. And hopefully there's good competition in the future.
Well, that is very much the desirable outcome. Often people feel that they can't really cooperate because somebody is going to break the agreement and they're going to race ahead. But this is what humanity can do. We can develop democratic and state institutions to prevent individuals breaking that agreement. So there's a fascinating example from the history of child labor in the UK. There was for a while in the early phase of the Industrial Revolution, lots of children being employed in factories, where often, by the way, they suffered horrific accidents. The reason they were employed in factories is because they were smaller than humans. They could squash more children in a small space. Their fingers were nimbler than humans. And it was terrible, despite many of the apparent great and good of society saying, well, what else would these children be doing? Even John Wesley, the famous leader of the Methodists, and he's on record as praising this system, saying children don't need that other kind of education. This is a good way for them to learn to grow up. I'm sure I paraphrased that wrongly, but if people search for that, they can see that example. But many of the factory owners disliked it. Despite that they were employing these children, they were unhappy to do so. Nevertheless, as what they said to Parliament is, well, if we individually stop doing it, we'll be outcompeted by these other guys over there who are still using children. So what we need to do is we need to get legal things passed through Parliament. So there's new standards which are to be followed. And secondly, very importantly, there had to be inspectors. So there were inspectors who came to factories unannounced without any warning to check that there were in fact no children there. And so that's how they could all move from using children and depriving children of often their fingers, but also of a proper upbringing. And they're moving to much higher levels of age before people could work. And even then, there were limits on how many hours people who are still relatively young could work. So that's what the AI companies sometimes say they would like to happen, but they're not making it happen enough. In part, it's more complicated because it's a global problem now rather than just a national problem. Doesn't matter if the British Parliament said, hey, all you AI companies need to cooperate, because there are other companies outside the scope of the British Parliament, of course. So that's why it has to be global. So one of the most important messages is that if we want governance of AI so that we end up in the sustainable superabundance rather than hell on earth, we need to have global coordination as never before.
And how would you recommend that global coordination happens? And what things are happening at the moment that you are inspired by or do you admire in this instance?
Well, we're not doing it very well, to be frank. This last week, there were meetings at the United Nations in New York. Once a year, they have the so-called high-level week in which you get people from high-ranking positions in the governments all around the world. And there were some discussions about AI there, but it's often quite a short term. They're refusing to accept many times the bigger existential or catastrophic risk scenarios. So they spend time on some worthy issues, but they're not able to address the bigger issues. And one problem with the United Nations is there's a great deal of virtue signaling. People say, well, I agree with this grand plan for ethics. I agree with this grand plan for justice and fairness, but they aren't specific enough about how we're actually going to change things. So the United Nations is trying, and there are many people connected with the United Nations who are trying to raise the caliber of thinking there. But in parallel, there are many other connections. So there are connections between the most interesting and thoughtful computer scientists in Americas, in Europe, and in China, critically in China, who are meeting on a regular basis in various places. So there was a Singapore consensus a few months ago, and there was a conference in Shanghai, the World AI Congress. I may have got the name of that wrong. I think it's WAIC. Where, not necessarily on the main stage, but inside discussions, people were talking together how they could nudge this along. So the people in these different countries do recognize the importance of working together, but it's still not changing fast enough. And so I'll answer your question a different way. How can we make the progress go faster? And part of it is a recognition, a clear recognition of the risks ahead. When people can see war looming, suddenly it focuses the mind. And so there should be much more of an awareness of that these risks aren't just some science fiction hypotheticals. They are quite likely, in fact. Hence the importance of the book by Eliezer Yudkowsky and Nate Soares I mentioned earlier. So that's part of it. But even more than knowing there's a danger, people need to have some credible options spelled out to them how we can solve the problems. And so this is a second level of education, not about just about the dangers, but also about the solutions. And there are candidate partial solutions, which involve controlling the spread of chips, so that if there are the powerful chips, which are needed in large numbers to create new versions of AI, more capable than today's, there should be carefully controlled distribution and limits as to what these chips factories can do. Alongside that, we need to explain that there are ways to monitor this. We can build self-monitoring into the chips. Also very important is we must point out that even if we do constrain the AIs from being developed in such and such a way, there's still a very good future ahead of us using the kinds of things that Yoshua Bengio was talking about, which is scientist AI. That's AI that doesn't have independent volition, AI that's kept much more under control. So it will be more powerful and more intelligent than today's AI. It will solve some of the problems I mentioned in nanotech, biotech, and cognitech, but it won't end up with these dreadful circumstances. So there's a positive vision ahead. And the fifth and final thing that people need to realize that goes along with awareness of the risks, awareness of the solutions, awareness of monitoring possibilities, and awareness of the very positive solution that can be achieved. The fifth thing they need to understand is that we can get there incrementally. We don't need to have a big bang solution that involves every company in the world all at once. We can build this alliance in stages via a conditional agreement whereby companies say, well, you know what? I will agree to do this provided these other companies all sign up to do it as well. So via this conditional agreement, you can go step by step into a more successful and sustained global agreement.
Yeah, totally understand your points. What does success look like by 2040?
Success looks like sustainable superabundance. It means that people have much more freedom to pursue the kinds of things they wish, with the higher levels of intelligence, higher levels of health and vitality, higher levels of flourishing, higher levels of environmental health as well than before. And by 2040, we will be starting to explore the wider solar system. There may well be people on Mars at that stage. But we will also be exploring the inner universe as well as the outer universe, as I've talked about earlier.
Wow, you think we'll be on Mars in 2040? That's a lot of change. Maybe we will. I heard Demis say that we're going to see 100 years of change in 10 years. That's kind of the speed that we're changing.
Yes, it's exponential speed up. That was first articulated by Ray Kurzweil, the futurist, in books he wrote back in the 1990s, such as The Age of Spiritual Machines, which drew people's attention first to this exponential speed up and the consequences of the exponential speed up.
That's a good point, actually. Do you see spirituality being the same as consciousness? And do you think that machines will become conscious?
Well, to be frank, we don't fully understand consciousness and we don't fully understand spirituality. There's multiple things involved, likely, in consciousness. There's not just being cognitively aware of things, but there's a visceral feeling that goes alongside it. It's not just a bunch of software. There's a sense of self. So how these emerge is not entirely clear. Whether it would be good for AIs to be truly conscious in any of these aspects, as opposed to just simulating consciousness, which many of today's AIs do, that's an open question. I'm on the side that I don't want AIs to become conscious, because the more conscious they are, the more likely they are to be autonomous, to have action, independent volition, and therefore not to be controlled by humans. So for the time being, I'm urging us not to develop AIs with any true elements of consciousness. But later on, once we are confident we understand the path to safe AI, then it may well be the case that we will bring into being more profound consciousnesses, more profound spirituality than we've ever had before.
Yeah, I think that's a conscious AI will be very interesting to see. So I think we've covered all the main questions. The last question is a question to you to ask a question to the audience that you want them to answer in the comments.
So my question to the audience is... Oh, I wasn't ready for this. So
no problem. It's okay, Tim.
So my question to the audience is to be frank with themselves. What is holding them up from being more morally ambitious in their lives? What is holding them up from pursuing not just economic success, but actually building this greater flourishing for everybody? What is holding them up from changing part of their life so that more of it's focused on these higher goals than just on the day-to-day stuff, which sadly tends to squeeze out these higher thoughts? So what are the blockages? And then following on from that, what are ways in which you might free yourself from some of these blockages? And by the way, you might, audience members, find answers to these questions by discussing with your favorite chatbots. But don't take everything that the chatbot says as gospel truth. You yourself need to reflect on it very carefully before making any change in your actual life.
Yeah, very profound questions. I think the ultimate aim would be to have so much time that we get to read a lot, to explore, to ask deeper questions around how we can all help each other, right? That's the aim of the ALI team, is to help bring awareness of different topics around AI together and to get people thinking about the future of the world, really, with AI at the center. So thank you for your time. Thanks for the question.
My pleasure.
It'll be an interesting to see the comments and the answers to the questions. And don't forget, to everyone who's listening, we have 20% off Oxford courses ending on the 5th of October. for many different courses. So take a look at the website at thealicm.com, and hopefully we'll have David back for another one soon.
You're welcome.